they are starting to limit power, but not necessarily just on FT8. And they say, okay, for FT8 in a contest, you can only run 100 watts. Of course, some people, it's their own station, and it's legal, they'll do what they want. But, yeah, it is kind of interesting I find it interesting to see the stuff you can work on FT8 when you think the band is dead. I worked Cypress once just about his sunrise on FT8 on 160 meters. He was pretty loud at least for a few minutes. I probably could have worked the guy on CW if he was on there. Anyway, that was kind of interesting. Anyway, probably time to move on, so I'll let you go. I'll probably be back later for the space report. WB2BX.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you for participating. So, Paul, hopefully we kind of chewed on this topic a bunch, and I'll keep an eye on it, as I'm sure you'll keep an eye on it. Again, if you go down the list, there are so many inherently interesting technologies that kind of have come and never really kind of got where the original designers and promoters thought it would go and just kind of fizzled out and is left in a sub menu of some kind of software interpreter for these signals.
WB2CQT.
Yes.
Okay, I went to Google, and outside I hear sounds that sound like firecrackers. I hope they are firecrackers. There's only one calling frequency I can find for 3DB, and that's 14230. There's a Yahoo group for it, but I haven't looked for that. And they say the bandwidth is 1.1 KC. So that's all from here.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that added information. Did they mention when they first set that frequency up? Because, again, free DV is not something that they came up with a couple of days ago. The actual source material that's the basis goes back decades in a gentleman's PhD thesis. He kind of dusted it off and gave it to the open source community. And they've been playing with FreeDV. As I mentioned, there was even a plug-in for my my Flex 6700 more than 5 years ago. So that frequency probably has been in the band plans for at least 5 years.
Okay, one other thing that I read, you could take a computer, get yourself a headset, and two sound cards. I guess you need two because the computer needs to use its own for its own purposes. And download the software and connect the computer up to your radio, and you could do the free DV.
Well, yeah, because just use the free DV itself is not a modulation protocol. The free DV is simply a phoneme voice-based encoder and decoder. So you talk into the software, it breaks up your words into unique phonemes, translates that into a digital compressed version, and then sends it. You can send it through any modulation scheme that sends binary bits, and then takes it and reconnects it with the phonemes that they're coded for and gives you an audio voice. So you could use any modulation scheme with free DV. This particular one is going to use an incredibly efficient, advanced mode that I don't know whether you could simply run it through a standard transmitter without it being specifically designed, if it's not an SDR, to do that type of of modulation transmission.
Well, I just looked very quickly, but the guy that wrote this little article did explain how you could do it with a computer and a headset. That, you know, as I explained, there was one other thing I was going to say. Oh, since it's in my radio and I have this frequency 14230, in the daytime I will set it to that frequency and see if anything, if I hear anything come out of it.
Okay, sounds like a good experiment. So my understanding is your radio is capable of encoding and decoding free DV. I wasn't familiar that there was radios designed that way. Most radios I'm aware of can only operate with the, you know, the standard proprietary methods that use AMBI chips. They have fusion capability or DMR capability, or in the case of a lot of ICOM radios, they do D-Star, none of which are use the free DV codecs. They use the AMBI codecs, which is different. So you couldn't connect on one end an AMBI chip and the other end a free DV. They don't operate the same way.
Right. This was an SDR, came out as a kit. Chinese copied it. It's the MCHF, and you go through the menu, and it's mentioned in the literature I have also. You go through the menu, upper sideband, lower sideband, FM, AM, 3 dB, right there.
Okay, that makes sense. It's not proprietary, so not that Chinese manufacturers care about intellectual property, but yeah, software-defined radios are much, much more flexible than legacy radios. One of the many reasons that I'm a big fan of software-defined radio technology, that you can adjust bandwidth transmissions. It was mentioned earlier how narrow a single sideband frequency could be before it was no longer intelligible. When I'm looking at my PAN adapters, I often have my bandwidth set much narrower to receive than whoever it is that's transmitting. It's not unusual for a lot of people to transmit for something like a 2.7 kilocycle bandwidth, occasionally 3 kilocycles. Different radios are sort of designed for different bandwidths, and non-SDRs require swapping filters or switching filters in and out of line to affect the change of things like that. But with software-defined radios, as another person mentioned, you just move something around, and all of a sudden you're transmitting at a much more narrow bandwidth than you were 5 minutes ago. It's all done in software, thankfully.
Query?
Yes, query away.
Hey, C2PL, how are you? The MCHF comment. I have one of those radios that I built from the actual author of the project, and one of the Chinese versions, the RS-928 or whatever they called it. And I was wondering from the previous commenter what the software version is that you have. There's two different types, and there's many different versions, of course, that's constantly being updated. But just curious about that, because I need to dig out that radio and check it out if there are other modes and that are available. It's an HF radio, by the way, right, AC2PL.
Okay, let me answer that. I got to turn it on to see the software version. It's an older version of the software. And talk a little bit between you, and I'll come back.
Okay, Larry, we'll give you a little time to pull out the software version. Jeff, you weren't familiar that the SDR was capable of things like free DV?
Hey, C2PL. No, Roy, I didn't see it in the modes in the particular software version that I was running. So I had downloaded the the update from, there's a group in Germany that's doing software development for this particular platform, and it is all SDR, and they've added all kinds of nice DSP. A lot of science went into it, a lot of engineers working on it, that sort of thing. But the radio itself, I've built the version 6, which is basically a handheld radio if you can power it some way. Very nice form factor for that radio. Go ahead.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
What is the name? 3DB? FreeDB? I don't know if I'm clear on it.
FreeDB.
Oh, Delta Victor. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it stands for Free Digital Voice. It was there were a couple of, like, I think they were ex-hippies who were really into getting a open source encoder decoder available for people so that they didn't have to deal with AmbiChip laws and variances and such. Yes, Frank.
Yeah, 14230, as far as I know, has traditionally been the slow scan frequency since at least the 1970s, unless that's changed. So I would think putting free DV there in any quantity, especially now in the sunspot cycle, where, approaching its peak, I would see that as problematic. Get into a war with the slow scan gang.
Sorry, CQT here again.
Yeah, I just kind of pulled up Google. I could be completely wrong. It's kind of saying it's 14.236.
Okay, maybe I wrote it down wrong. Maybe I didn't have my glasses on. The software is D2.9.88, and this is not a Chinese model. This is boards from the same source that the other guy has.
Okay, so you got that down, Jeff?
Yeah, Roger. I've got version UH, Uniform Hotel Sierra Delta Romeo, UHSDR. That's the German development group. The software version is Delta 2.11.25, 2.11.25. Now, when I push the mode buttons here on the radio, I've only got it set for switching between CW upper and USB for 20 meters, for example. But the software menu is extensive, and I think I've disabled everything but that. So I don't know what other modes are available here. I'm going to have to scroll through. If you're interested, Andy, I will scroll a little bit, see if it's there, and I'll chime back in later.
Okay, the name here is Larry, and it's WB2CQT, and I'd certainly like to meet up with you sometime in the future with these radios. I'm chicken to install software. I leave well enough alone. So I'll let the conversation go back to whatever's going on, and I'll be listening.
Okay, very good, Larry. Very good, Jeff. Any other comments before we move on to the next person? Okay, I will take that as a no. Next on our list for tonight is John, KC2SHO. What's your question, comment, topic of discussion, what have you?
Yeah, good evening. I'm in the middle of something here. Can we can we do this just a little later? Would that be acceptable to KC2SHO?
Certainly. I'll move over down to Craig is next on our list, and when we're done with Craig, I'll come back to you, okay?
Sounds great. We'll chat then. EC2GS, KC2SHO.
Comment briefly.
Yes, comment briefly.
Sorry, Roy. Yes, it is. When I turn on the digital modes in the menu, FreeDV is indeed in that version of the software.
Okay, that's good. If you're planning on experimenting, please come back and tell us. Like I said, once upon a time, before Flex discontinued the whole idea, I had access to... I tried the D-Star, because the D-Star was a lot more productive for me. I was able to use D-Star to pick up D-Star repeaters in the area. But because next to no one was using FreeDV on either UHF, VHF, or HF, it was just there. I think I tried it a few times. I couldn't find any signal anywhere, and I just kind of gave up. And as I mentioned, Flex discontinued the entire API waveform plug protocol and moved on to something else. But let me know if you discover something useful. In my mind, unfortunately, FreeDV was more of a kind of a hippie movement than anything. I could have it completely wrong, but we'll see.
Back to
AC2. Okay, very well. Craig, you're up. KD2OGB, you said you had a question?
Perfect. KD2OGB, here is something that I thought of that could be a very big help and a quick way to do HF outside, besides using my car if I wanted to. All of my HF hamsticks have that little stud connector, and I have an adapter in my cart on Amazon. If I could, would it be possible to strap the antenna to a tripod and to get it just a little high up and do it that way?
Yes, you have to supply some form of a counterpoise. Hamsticks are basically quarter wave shortened antennas with a loading coil at the base. So mechanically they're short. They make up the extra inductance to make them resonant on the band you're interested by the loading coil that's kind of hidden in the base of the unit. And the tab is designed to it connects to some big piece of metal that acts as a counterpoise. Operating a quarter wave antenna without a proper counterpoise is akin to playing on a seesaw with half of the seesaw cut and thrown away.
Perfect. That is exactly what I wanted to hear from you. Because today I took my car out. As I mentioned earlier, I took it out to the docks in Patchogue, and using very low power on the HF, I made a number of contacts on 10 meters, preferably to Italy, and one to Cuba, and one to Belgium, and I was surprised with how many Italy contacts I got out there, but I was just smashing contact after contact after contact, and I'm like, boy, I think now I might be able to do this at home rather than just take my car out somewhere and just have it idle all day long.
Yeah, I see no reason why you can't set up temporary tripod-situated hamsticks and get similar performance. Again, as long as you offer some kind of radio or counterpoise, or what some people sometimes do is they will connect two hamsticks in opposite directions, and what they've effectively designed are shortened dipoles with loading coils in them. So if you supply two hamsticks opposite each other, you no longer need to supply some form of a counterpoise. It's a balanced antenna the way it is. But if you're just going to use one ham stick in order to efficiently operate it, you're going to have to offer the screw at the base a piece of wire that will act as an appropriate counterpoise for that type of antenna.
Here's a little loophole to get around that. What if I just did it vertically?
You can orient the ham stick any way that you would want to do. You're probably better off, all things being equal, to orient it vertically rather than horizontally, because horizontally oriented antennas benefit from heights. You want to have a horizontally oriented antenna that's at least a half of a wavelength above the ground. Otherwise, you'll get coupling to the ground, which will decrease the efficiency, and the reflections off of the ground will change the radiation pattern to something that's closely near vertical incident sky wave, something pointing straight up and above you, in which it limits your distances to communicate. But you can orient a ham stick any way that you would like to. Almost all mobile ham sticks I've ever seen tend to be oriented in the vertical position.
Okay, and that is 100% fine. I definitely look into doing that, and I would like to make a lot more contacts and try to get some of those awards. I'm already on my way to getting one of them, actually. Let's pull it up. But yeah, I really want to get a couple of them. At first, I wasn't really sure how to do the whole confirmation thing because I just didn't have a couple of things correct. But it turns out you need the frequency and the time. The frequency doesn't have to be exactly on the dot, but it needs to be near what you called them on, the same with the time as well.
Yeah, that's the usual requirement. A lot of people operate either portable or mobile. They operate in their cars, or they will go to a park or some kind of pleasant place outside and do all their work there, as opposed to in their house for a bunch of different reasons. So it certainly is doable. Many people have. There are even groups, parks on the air and other things on the air where the whole point is to get outside of your house. So even if you can't operate in your shack, which is probably the more convenient location, we shall say, there is a lot of other things that you can do and amass, worked all states or worked all this or that. It certainly is doable. A lot of people do it outside. There are some people who happen to love QRP, 5 watts and below, and they operate 5 watts, usually CW as such. But you could do it with more than 5 watts. You know, that's what batteries are for, and, you know, have fun.
Well, I hear another station there. I think it's Frank, anyway. WS1.
Yes, I think I heard him as well. He was doubling. Let's stay quiet for a little while and give Frank an opportunity to make his comment.
Yeah, very good, WB2BXO. I was just going to say, I've heard this from a number of people, that operating portable near the water, you get some gain from the reflection of the water. I may not be 100% right on the technical reason, but it does work better. So you may not get the same performance using the same antenna at your home location unless you're also right on the water that you get when you operate portable. So obviously it's more convenient if you can operate at home. But you may very well have, first of all, a higher noise level, which seems to be ubiquitous these days, and you're also going to have less gain because you get some gain by being by the water. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with you that ground wave propagation seems to be improved by saltwater conductive bodies. And also part of it, I think, is just the absence of structural buildings that get in the way that absorb RF. You know, when you're near the water, you have basically an opened horizon for a nice distance that's very helpful. So I, too, have had more than a few conversations of people who set up their equipment close to a waterfront area, and they're much easier to hear under those circumstances. Although homes are much comfier and convenienter, they also have more residential electric fields that can interfere and cause problems. So there are benefits of operating portable. You know, sometimes the old saying is, you take your lemons and you make lemonade out of them.
Yeah, I've noticed during the winter, you hear quite a few British mobiles on 40 and 80 meters who, I guess, sit near one of the harbors, I guess on their way to work in the morning and work stateside. You can just about hear them. The bigger stations, Beveridge antennas, can hear them more easily because they apparently have a great deal of difficulty getting permission to put up antennas in Great Britain. I've also heard guys on the West Coast sitting on the water's edge working Australia an hour early morning in hours. And one of the local guys who's on here occasionally, I think he's mentioned he drove to Canarsie Pier once years ago to work his own 23. I think it was a JT1CO literally outer Mongolia on 10 meters. So it does seem to make a big difference. Go ahead.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. I don't doubt that. Most of my anecdotal stories, at least lately on 10 meters, I've spoken to England, Scotland, Ireland. All of them, as far as I'm aware, have been in base stations. So I haven't really had that much experience. Locally, we have a few people who are regular check-ins to the 10-meter net who operate portable by, you know, inclination. And their signals tend to be consistently good, even though they pick different places, but it's always near a body of water. So apparently it can't hurt.
Yeah, buddy of my friend on the West Coast in the Bay Area, he has a little pond right outside his condo, and he gets, I don't think he's that near San Francisco Bay, but just this little pond seems to give him enough reflectivity to get incredible performance. He complains he works too many JAs and just doesn't call them anymore, and he runs no more than 100 watts to, I think, a screwdriver antenna with a proper counterpoise. Anyway, apparently it makes a really big difference. And, yeah, one of the guys from the local Philadelphia club retired to southern Spain because I think his children live there. I gave him your net frequency to try to work you guys, you know, when propagation is good enough. So it'll be interesting to see if with his apartment antenna he can work into your net. Anyway, once again, I'm going to go back to listening. Sounds like we got a good conversation going for a change. WB2BX.
Okay, very good, Frank. You know, still, unfortunately, there are one-sided cases. You know, although Dick, may rest in peace, used to talk a lot about the reciprocity of antenna systems. That's, you know, that's the antenna itself. There's a lot of other factors that kind of screw around with reciprocity. Just because you hear someone doesn't mean they hear you, or vice versa. About 6 weeks or so ago, I got an email after a 10-meter net from a very pleasant gentleman from Poland who I did not contact. He said that he heard my signal, and he tried to be heard, but no one around Brooklyn could hear him, unfortunately. So I sent his children, who are fascinated with postcards of landmarks of New York City. My QSL card is the Brooklyn Bridge, so I sent them a couple of weeks ago. So and asked them if he wants to return the favor, you know, try again to contact us some Sunday morning. So, you know, not all signals that we hear are heard by our responses aren't heard by the people that we can hear, and vice versa. So, you know, that's one of the vagaries of this hobby. If it was simple, then people would just put away their amateur radio gear and just use their cell phones instead. So I'm thankful for that aspect of the hobby as well.
Yeah, I think we had a discussion about the one-way skip issue a couple of weeks ago. All else being equal, antennas should be reciprocal, but the noise level, especially now with urban noise levels, the noise levels are often different in different locations, and it just doesn't seem to work. But that is interesting. Hopefully, if conditions improve, he'll be able to work the net. Next year and the year after should be even better than this year. Go ahead.
I certainly hope so. Only the future will tell. About a month or so ago, one of the conversations we were having on this technical net was the dismal predictions of cycle 25. And I linked to a site where they took the model calculations of cycle 25 and the actual recorded measurements of activity and plotted them together. And it was amusing to see that the theoretical model was significantly lower at every point of the path of the real sun's activity that has happened before during this time period. So the model apparently is erring on the side of less activity than is actually occurring. So I'm hoping it continues to get better. The nature usually of sunspot cycles is the rise is the rate of rise is much faster than the rate of decline. So you have a steeper angle going up to the peak and then a slightly less steep angle dropping back down to the minimum. So it should be a fun ride. We'll see what it gives us.
I was hearing South Americans on 6 meters today, so that's encouraging. So it's hard to tell whether that's true F-layer propagation or E-skip. It sounded like HF-style F-layer propagation, at least for part of the path. That's encouraging. We'll see what happens. It looks like McIntosh, the guy who predicted a higher sunspot cycle in the consensus forecast, may be vindicated, and I'm sure it's going to save, if that works out, it's going to save his academic butt.
Unfortunately, I see this very similar to, I used to get the Wall Street Journal regularly, and they would do articles about financial planners who had guessed right and those who had not guessed right. And finally, some clever person set up, I think it might have been monkeys throwing darts at a board and discovering that the monkeys had the same kind of chance as most of the licensed financial planners out there. So I think he guessed right. I don't know if he knows anything more than the guys who guessed wrong. But the nature of guessing is if you guess right, you get awards. And sometimes if you guess wrong, you can convince people that you never said that.
Well, let's not even start that conversation. That seems to be a favorite game of politicians these days. Anyway, I'm going to be on the side here, as they say, on 80 meters, and let me move on to the net, and I'll be back in a bit later. WB2BXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thanks again for your participation. Getting back to you, Craig, I wish you good luck. Like I said, there's a lot of people who take all kinds of different antenna types. They use hamsticks. They use magnetic loops. They put them on tripods. Some of them require a small counterpoise. There was a gentleman that I talked to on, I'm not quite sure if it was this technical net or the other technical net, they kind of merge in my mind, who is going to use a tunable counterpoise. So he's going to have a very short wire. He's going to tune it up as the counterpoise and use that as an antenna on a stand. So I wish you good luck. It has been done before. It will be done again, and I wish you all the luck with it.
Thanks. Like I said, I'm going to go for the vertical part. KD2OGB, back to AC2GS, net control.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Let me see, John, if you're out there. Are you ready, or do you need more time? I guess he needs more time. Well, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button and tell me about them.
KD2KFR.
Yes, KFR.
That was Kilo Delta 2. Kilo Frank Igloo, thanks for the acknowledgement. I am in a 19th-floor apartment. I am working on setting up my first HF shack, and I am having some difficulties with the antenna I'm using.
Okay. What's your first name?
Steve.
It got kind of cut off. We'll push the button, wait a second or two, and then tell me your first name.
Sorry about that. First name, Steven.
Okay, good, Steven. So what frequencies are you interested in, and how many bands are you interested in, and what kind of antenna have you considered using? Do you plan to use it indoors, outdoors, or near the window?
Right now, I have the Yaesu ATAS mounted on the frame of the window, but it's outside, and I'm interested in really whatever bands I can work. Just trying to get into HF now, as opposed to using the repeaters. So I'm working with that.
Okay. So you're using a length of wire, and you're using an antenna tuner to correct for non-residents. Is that correct?
No, there's a no. I'm using a vertical antenna. It's the Yaesu ATAS-120. It tunes itself according to the Yaesu 991A. There's no counterpoise on it, and it's not grounded. And I just got a MFJ artificial ground, just trying to figure this stuff all out.
Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, you're trying to operate a tuned quarter wave of vertical. but you really do need a counterpoise. Without either an artificial counterpoise or an actual counterpoise, it's sort of akin of playing on a seesaw with only half the seesaw in place. So you can kind of see that there's no other side. It's unbalanced. So in order to get a somewhat efficient getting your RF to kind of take off on your radiating antenna, you're going to have to supply some form of a counterpoise. If you're going to go with the artificial counterpoise, you're going to have to adjust it according to whatever band you plan to operate. So that's a kind of trial, test it and try it. I hate to sound redundant, but vector network analyzers are very helpful in that, as I've mentioned earlier tonight, it will give you a much better sense of what your antenna configuration is capable of. Theoretically, you could just go from frequency to frequency and send out a little transmission signal and detect what the return percentage is and what the standing wave ratio is and that. But if you, it would be to me easier to just kind of sweep the frequency at least for one given band. That way you could twiddle with the artificial counterpoise and hopefully help the residents be nearby where you want it to be. You might not want a vector network analyzer, but they're available for under $100, and they help with a lot of issues of why an antenna is not operating as well as it might otherwise.
Thanks for the information. I appreciate that. What would I do for a real counterpoise?
Usually the way most people use counterpoises is anywhere from a quarter of a wavelength to an eighth of a wavelength piece of wire is dangled from the ground part of the antenna, and oftentimes left to droop in a way that's not dangerous to anyone else. In some cases, especially on very high frequencies, people just use lumps of metal. Often you'll see people use a magnetic mount antenna designed for cars, but instead of putting it on a car, they'll put it on a external air conditioner cover. Sometimes when people can't operate their antennas outdoors, they'll sit it on their refrigerator, and the metal mass will be sufficient to act as a counterpoise. But for HF, if you were operating, say, 40 meters and you wanted something that would work decently as a counterpoise, it would probably end up being something like 10 meters or about 30 feet. You might try 15 feet, cut it in half, and you get a compromise of something that's effective but not long enough to be a nuisance in managing.
Man, you really just gave me some information for an idea that I had, because people normally use this antenna I have as a mobile antenna, and I was thinking about mounting it to my air conditioner, which is a window-mounted air conditioner. So maybe I'll give that a try and see if that metal cover back there will suffice.
Okay, yeah, you can try it. The worst that could happen is it won't be very efficient, but it may still get you strong signals. It's usually more effective, as I mentioned, for UHF and VHF because the wavelengths are much shorter. So effectively, a refrigerator or something is long enough to be a proper counterpoise. Whereas if you were looking for some of the lower frequency HF bands, 180 meters as an extreme example, that's a very long wavelength. So getting something a quarter or an eighth of that wavelength is a lot of wire. So a an air conditioner, housing would be far less effective in the case of lower frequencies. But you could experiment and see what level of compromise suffices.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. And last question, if you don't mind. People say wire a lot of times, and I'm not sure if the gauge or the guards of the wire makes a difference. Is there a specific wire that people are using for a counterpoise?
No, it simply has to be reasonably good conducting wire. Copper is an excellent conductor of wire, conducting wire. Its limitations are that it's a soft metal and can stretch under tension. In the case of counterpoises and antennas, wires, the importance for large diameters is primarily mechanical and power dissipation. The thicker gauge wire you use, the stronger it will stay and not snap if the wind blows on it, and the greater the power you can put into it without it overheating and melting and becoming brittle and falling apart. People use all kinds of different wires for both counterpoise and antennas. They use bare wires, they use insulated wires, they use copper, they use solid single core, they use stranded multi-core, they use steel that's cladded in copper. That gives you the benefit of two different things. The steel core will give you a stable dimensional wire. It's much more tougher and less ductile. It won't be stretched out of shape. And because RF is going through the skin of your wire, just covering it in a layer of copper will give you all the effective conducting ability that if you had a solid copper wire. The downside with steel-clad copper is that it can sometimes be a little bit difficult to handle. They feel a little bit on the springy side. They tend to like to keep their shape. So if you have it coiled to begin with, you uncoil it, it's a little bit cumbersome. But that's a very popular type of wire that are used. But, you know, you could use anything that properly conducts electricity for your antenna and your counterpoise.
Thank you for the information, sir. This is KD2KFI. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Stephen. I wish you good luck. And if you come up with any other technical questions, problems that you'd like to ask about, you know where to find us all. We're here every Sunday night starting at 8 p.m. And I hope you come back and tell us how your antenna is working for you.
Thank you. I'll definitely be back. I appreciate it again.
You're welcome, Stephen. Thank you for participating. Let's see if John is back. John, are you back yet? Okay, I guess not yet. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. We've been doing this, someone's been doing this for 43 years. I haven't been doing this for 43 years. I've only been doing this for about 3 years and helping out for a couple of years before. If there's anyone out there who has any questions or topics for discussion or comments to make, please feel free.
W2BC.
Yes, Rich.
Just a comment to Stephen. I also use an MFJ artificial ground, and I find it works best on 40 meters. And what you do, you attach it to the ground of your rig, and then you run a wire from the artificial ground out wherever you can put it along the side of the wall, and then you tune it by tuning the inductance first, and then the other knob for maximum reading. And like I say, it the meter really deflects on 40 meters into a shortened NZ half wave, but on 10 and 15 and 20, I barely get a reflection on it. Don't know why, but use it. Definitely use it, especially on 40 and maybe 80 if you're going to work 80. But try it on all bands. And what you do is you set the sensitivity knob for maximum and then see if you get a deflection, and then you could cut back on the sensitivity if you get a big deflection, and then tune the other knob for maximum also. So, but don't not use it, because it can help greatly. That's the comment, Roy, W2BZ.
Okay, and also he could use it in league with whatever he wants to use as a counterpoise to extend the adjustability of the effectiveness of whatever he's planning to use as a counterpoise.
Exactly. Whatever he's using, he could add the MFJ artificial ground and get some help from it.
Yeah, I agree. And although, practically speaking, you can interpret an increase in background noise as a decrease SWR and a more efficient transfer of the background noise into your receiver circuits, you as an owner of two vector network analyzers, and I'm an owner of three vector network analyzers, I still kind of like to have a visual sense of exactly what's going on. So if either you don't want to have one or you just don't have one, you certainly can use your ears and listen to the background noise as a rough approximation. But I find that frequency sweeps, when done correctly, give you a lot more information that you could use to optimize things.
And as I said last week, if you have a nano VNA and it's acting wonky and there are sweeps going all over the place, there are two reset buttons in the menu. There's a reset and enter DFU, and then there's a separate reset button. That's the one that resets it back to the original state of the kernel of quote-unquote the operating system, and that's the one you have to use. That solved all my problems. Back to net.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Rich. That's good knowledge to know. I wish the NanoVNA had a standard manual attached to it someplace. There's a lot of useful information, but it tends to be scattered in all four directions on the Internet. I think some people have tried to write a book. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, I think that the Royal Society of Great Britain actually publishes a book recently. I just saw it about a month or so ago on using a nano VNA. I haven't had a chance to order it and thumb through it, but hopefully that's going to provide some people with a better sense of what's going on in the nano VNA and be able to better use it. But I thank you for your input on this, Rich. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limewire Technical Net. If anyone has any comments on our previous subject or they would like to introduce a new subject, then please feel free.
Um,
W2BZ, I wanted to respond or ask a question of W2BZ.
Frank recognized, Stephen recognized. Stephen, you wanted to ask W2BZ a question. Please feel free.
Thanks for the information. I was curious to know two things, if you wouldn't mind answering for me. One, on your artificial ground, I just got mine today, so I don't have the long wire set up. But I'm noticing my inductance and capacitance knobs continue to turn all the way around. They don't have a stop. I'm wondering if yours does that or if mine is broken. And secondly, I'm wondering the length of your ground wire that you have, not to the radio, but the one that you have against your wall.
That's about 16 feet, the wire I have against the wall. I didn't cut it for that. That's the amount of wire I had. Operate it is you first tune the inductance knob or turn the inductance knob to the setting where you get the maximum deflection and keep the sensitivity knob to the highest setting first. Then go to the inductance and tune around that knob to see where you get a reflection. When you get a reflection, that's when you tune the capacitance for highest reflection. That's how it works. So it's a three-step thing. First, you turn the sensitivity all the way up. Then when you key your transmitter, you see where you're getting, what setting of inductance you're getting a reflection on. And then when you choose the inductance setting that you get the most reflection on, if you get any at all, then you tune the sensitivity for the most reflection. Do you understand that?
Yes, copy. I do understand that. So sensitivity at max, then go to the inductance, and then go to the last knob, the capacitance. What I'm wondering is your knobs, do they continue, this is just a mechanical question, do your knobs continue to turn all the way around on the inductance and the capacitance? Mine's continue to turn all the way around 360 degrees and then it'll go around again.
Let's see. Yes. On the inductance, Not on the sensitivity. The sensitivity has a full stop. But on the inductance and the capacitance, they go around 360 degrees.
Okay, thank you for that information. I was a little worried there. So I will, I'll speak to you guys next Sunday, hopefully if you're here again. And after I get some long wire, I'll report back and tell you how this thing is working out.
Okay, very good, Stephen. I wish you good luck, and all things being equal, we should be here next week. We're here every week. So thank you, Stephen. Frank, you wanted to say something.
Yes, WB2BX, Cell here. I wanted to make sure, maybe I'm confused. Talking about the ground on the back of the radio, which I believe is different than a counterpoise. I remember playing with an artificial MFJ artificial ground about 40 years ago, my memory again may be faulty on this, but I don't think the artificial ground is designed to duplicate a counterpoise. I think it's designed to give you an artificial electrical ground, say when you're in it, as Steve is, in an upstairs apartment and don't have a good earth ground. Am I correct on that? Go ahead, Roy.
I think it's meant to be a adjustable counterpoise, not actually designed for for optimizing your you know lightning protection. You theoretically you could use that, although it would probably burn out the components, to neutralize the inductance of say a ground strip that goes from the base of your antenna on the roof to a ground rod. But I think primarily